Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and I'm here today with Scott Lemieux and Rob Farley. We are having our now twice a month discussion of contemporary politics. Hello, gentlemen. How are you doing?
Very well.
Doing great. How are you?
I'm doing well. I have a Proclamation Derivative Citrus Single Hop Pale from Warwick, Rhode Island here, Rhode Island's finest brewery, in my opinion. So I am doing okay, and I hope everyone is having an appropriate beverage out there as well. I think the first thing to talk about today is the impending stimulus package, which I have, you know, I'm glad to see it. I have some sort of mixed feelings about, but I think that at least finally something is happening on this front. Scott, do you want to start by talking about that a little bit?
Yeah, and I thought, you know, it's sort of an interesting thing in that, you know, essentially by holding out for getting direct payments, I think that the left of the Democratic caucus was trying to make this a point about austerity. And while the point is good, the problem is that Republicans control two of the three veto points and weren't going to significantly increase, you know, are not going to pass a $1 trillion package. So what ended up happening is that, we traded a month of extended unemployment benefits for what looks like $600 checks. I thought that Levitz actually made, you know, reasonable that it's not, you know, as big of a cell phone as it's being portrayed as, you know, and I think essentially the argument he made is that if we can win the runoffs, and which this probably makes marginally less likely, you know, who knows, but I don't think it will be determinative or anything. Then, you know, it should be pretty easy to reconciliation bill to just extend the UI benefits. And then, you know, it's a win. If you don't win those, you know, basically, I think you're getting somewhat worse policy for somewhat better politics, which is interesting. He did try to make the case that, the checks would have a greater stimulus effect because they get some people who aren't eligible for UI. But that seems really implausible to me just because, it's true that the checks get some people who don't get UI, but a lot of these checks are just going to end up in people's banks accounts or index funds or whatever. So it does seem like UI is the best, you know, even it's spread out a little more. But I think like as stimulus, UI is better and it's a little better targeted. But it's not the end of the world. And I do think that, you know, giving people checks, is something that, you know, is you know, better for the House incumbents will need. So I don't have strong feelings about it, but I don't know how you two gentlemen evaluate the trade-offs.
Well, so do you recollect, Scott, what the if there was an additional allowance for people with children? Because last time it was, $1,200 plus $300 per kid. Do you recollect anything about that in this particular bill? Because that affects my enthusiasm for this bill, right? Because I don't have to, they don't read the news. I mean, you know, they could read the news, but you know, that money goes right into my sweet bourbon. So,
yeah, I cannot, you know, I seem to think, and I know like Holly's thing has, that he's throwing tomorrow is like, there's a $500 kid bonus with a $1,200 stimulus, but I haven't seen anything about a bonus for children in this one, but I don't know.
Okay. All right. Well, we can figure it out later. No big deal.
Yeah. But that's actually a good question.
Right. I mean, I guess my thinking is largely similar to yours regarding the sort of the politics and the impact. Politically, in the end, I'm not sure how much of an effect this is going to have on anything beyond even. I mean, so the actual effect is not going to happen before January 6th, right? The checks aren't even really going to be mailed before January 6th, and so. Except for people who pay a lot of attention, this is not going to affect a lot of votes. And, you know, 2022 is so far away that anything that happens right now, it's really hard to track down and say that it's going to have some sort of meaningful effect down the road, right? So I think we can really start just judging this by its merits. And on that, unemployment insurance, you know, in the end is more important than the cash money, but then the cash money will have a stimulative effect, right? So,
you know, my thought on it is not so much about this particular, the details of this bill, which I think are, you know, about as much as was going to happen. I don't know what the pressure points were going to be that was really going to force a better bill. But back in, you know, April, March and April, when the first big relief bill was passed, maybe it was the second. Anyway, the one that sent out the $1,200 checks. There was some compromises in that bill. And, I do remember some on the kind of internet left sort of saying, well, you know, Democrats really kind of failed here. And me sort of saying, well, or thinking, well, you know, there's going to be other bills, but then, you know, there wasn't, right? And I think that there, I think that, you know, substantively, I think that that kind of left critique back in the spring was actually fundamentally correct. I mean, I think it's very easy to, it was easy for me to imagine in under these extreme circumstances of Mitch McConnell saying, oh my God, you know, we have to do something, our political careers are based on it, and we're going to lose in November if we don't. But then it never happened. And so, you know, there is perhaps an object lesson here about, in a true crisis scenario, about maximizing your leverage and forcing everything down the throat of Republicans in the very rare times that's possible. But, you know, that's a moment that was kind of lost. And I don't necessarily blame anybody, because I think everybody thought there was going to be additional stimulus packages or other sorts of relief during the summer and the fall, and it never happened. And, you know, the lack of any, the refusal of McConnell and Republicans to include any state and local aid is, to me, is just shocking. I mean, this is just devastating for a state like my own in Rhode Island, which is such a, you know, poor state, New England. And, you know, so, you know, I'll take what we can get at this point, but it is something that we have not, this is the first thing that's happened now in, you know, 7 or 8 months.
Although, I mean, I think that cuts both ways, though, because the premise, and again, I should say that, unlike for something like the ACA, I think it's plausible we could have gotten more. I don't think it's clear cut, but I think that the one issue is that the assumption that we could have gotten a lot more in the CARES Act sort of assumes that Republicans just weren't going to be willing to walk away. But we also have now gotten evidence that they're, you know, they literally sacrificed the presidency. And one thing I do think is that state and local aid was going to be like, that seems for whatever reason to be the, like the Senate conference just seems to have convinced themselves that all that money will go to like 5 Democratic cities. Like it's really strange, but like, it seems to me we could have gotten more of other things. But it really seems like state and local aid is just an absolute third rail. And I do think it's clever to basically, at least we got the immunity out, and to basically say, like, you know, you only get immunity if you get the state and local aid. So basically, you know, either you get both or neither. But, and I don't really understand, you know, given that, you know, that there are a lot of Republican states are really taking the brunt of this, but for whatever reason, that seems to be. If it was an all or nothing, we could have gotten it in March, but that really seems like it would have been a hell of a gamble, because Republicans do seem willing to walk away and do nothing. So it's a really tricky to evaluate.
I mean, I think that the state and local aid thing touches on a bunch of different sort of ideological points for Republicans, right? And I think, you know, for what it's worth, they are sort of genuinely, they are genuinely held, right? And one of those is that state and local governments tend to be, sort of these bloated bureaucracies that are all about employing people, right? They're political machines, right? They're basically to give out jobs in really inefficient ways that distort the labor market, all this other nonsense that Republicans like to say, right? And that especially blue states ought not to be able to coast. And I think also sort of the extent to which the Republican Party is sort of the party of the petty bourgeois, right, the used car dealers on the edge of town, right, when those car dealers think about government, they're primarily thinking about state and local governments, right? It's, you know, they are sort of worried about what the state and local government are going to do in the regulatory scheme to them, right? And so that's who the enemy is for the petty bourgeois, who are, you know, fiercely Republican, right? And so the idea that federal funds would be bailing out state and local governments is really completely antithetical to the used car dealers on the edge of town, who make up sort of the core of the Republican base.
And I think it's just worth, you know, it becomes easy because for people who have even the slightest sense of humanity and can't imagine just letting people die on the vine, the level of antipathy that Republicans have for actual human life. And, you know, they just say no, like they don't care. It just doesn't matter. And of course their voters are also fine with that. Right. I mean, this is the kind of the big conundrum of 2020 in some ways, is that, you know, you have the worst president in American history on top of a horribly managed pandemic that is, you know, the worst, you know, whatever, deaths above average is what you know, 400,000 down this year. Like, it doesn't matter. They win seats in the House based on this. So I don't know, you know, what are they, you know, what's the downside for them? And you know, I know Paul Waldman had that piece today that was kind of about that. And I don't know, you know, it works for them. So it's a big problem.
Yeah, the DeSantis one dose thing is the one that kills you. Like, I don't even like what there's no lib owning. It's not saving any money. Like, it's just literally, you know, like what, like, it's just, you know, it's just like insane, but you know, it's just like, that's just,
it's what they are. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think that to a certain extent, if there's a benefit from 2020, it's and especially, you know, not only the election itself, but in the post-election and the dead enders, you know, the Trump dead enders and all of this, that it really, I think that people left, liberal and center, were telling themselves stories about America that they wanted to believe that were not in fact true. About the voters, about the Republican Party, about the political system, about things actually do work, the institutions work. It's like, no, they don't. Like, you know, I mean, as Paul has pointed out, several posts, you know, only took a few thousand votes in key states, and Trump would have won despite us losing the popular vote by 6%. Or 6 million, I guess. Sorry, not 6%, but 6 million. And so
over 75 million votes. Eric, over 75 million.
Exactly. I mean, you know, and over 80 million, I mean, that doesn't mean anything, you know, so it's the 75 that counts. You know, and so I think that it's just easy to think, oh, you know, the Republicans will eventually come around and do something for people. It's like, no, they're just not going to. Like, they just don't care. And that's something I think we're all kind of figuring out what to do with that information right now, if we're even really admitting it. And another topic, and Scott, you pointed out earlier this week in a post that your position that Bill Barr is the worst attorney general in American history. And I only wanted to say that John Mitchell's decaying corpse is really pissed off right now. I mean, what more? Like, the man literally had his own wife kidnapped so she wouldn't leak Watergate. Like, how? I mean, shouldn't that be the all-time winner for worst attorney general?
Yeah, it's Vega. If you guys can nail John Mitchell, that would be beautiful. No, I mean, that is certainly the other candidate. There's just something about Barr, you know, and again, there was, you know, there's actually a lot of commonalities in terms of their corruption. You know, if you wanted to make the case for Mitchell, you could also point, you know, I keep meaning to get to this post, but Adam Cohen's excellent new book on the Supreme Court really gets into this, that, you know, what's infuriating about Abe Fortas being forced off the court is that, you know, it's like Nixon and Mitchell were not hiding what they were doing. And Earl Warren had known both of them since like Moses was in kindergarten. It's not like, you know, and he hated both of them and yet just allowed him to be bullied into this, you know, like basically persuading Fortas to resign over like pretty penny ante, you know, especially John Mitchell pretending to be like, give a shit about like Abe Fortas's speaking fees. So that's it. You know, I guess that there's just something about, you know, the sheer level of, you know, I mean, you know, like stuff like, you know, Barr claiming that like Trump couldn't be sued for things he said before he was president, you know, because like, you know, the sort of mischaracterization of the Mueller report. But, you know, it's really, and then it's adjusting for era. I mean, you know, so I mean, if you want to say Mitchell was worse, I'm not going to argue with you. I mean, and I do think, and, you know, obviously one hobby horse of the blog in general has been the sort of, you know, against the liberal rehabilitation of Nixon. You know, that, you know, yeah, like he did not veto every piece of good legislation the Democratic Congress put on his desk, but, you know, he was, and really, you know, and this is, you know, all of, you know, Rick Perlstein's, you know, quartet makes this clear, but, you know, that's, you know, obviously Reagan is the most obvious predecessor to Trump, but, you know, there was, you know, the age of Nixon, there's a lot of antecedents to Trump there. And so I think that's a, you know, a good comparison. But I think one interesting thing is that like Mitchell in that era was never integrated back into, you know, polite, you know, legal society again. Nixon himself was, but like generally his henchmen were not. Whereas, you know, I'd be very interested to see what happens to Barr, you know, given what we've seen is just the default assumption of like a lot of elite liberal people that, you know, once Republican hacks have fancy law degrees, they're really different than, you know, so, you know, are we going to get Bill Barr writing New York Times op-eds about how, you know, John Yoo is going to be the greatest attorney general in history? You know, it's just very, It's really tricky. But yeah, I mean, I certainly did not mean to diminish John Mitchell, you know, and I think that they had a lot in common.
Well, I mean, the name here, I would also bring up, and somebody brought this up on Twitter. Actually, a conservative, a friend of mine, brought this up on Twitter. Was that right? That you know, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions is basically the person who brought Stephen Miller into public prominence, right? And that this has to be included as a significant debit on his already disgraceful tenure as Attorney General, right? So Wikipedia tells me there have been 85 Attorneys General of the United States, and even if we rank Barr as number 85, and maybe Mr. Sessions cannot be much higher than that, right?
Oh, right, yeah, and that's. It's amazing that somebody who was rejected by a Republican Senate as a too racist is not the worst attorney general that Bush has ever had. But he was awful, you know, and in terms of policy, at least as evil as Barr. It's just that, like, you know, Sessions actually, like, cared about policy, but was not a complete Trump lickspittle. Very much, very similar to the John Ashcroft, Alberto Gonzalez dynamic, in which you know, Ashcroft was, if anything, more evil than Gonzalez, but, you know, he was principled enough that he wasn't just willing to be Bush's total lickspittle in the way that Gonzalez was. So I think that's a pretty good comparison, except that I think that, you know, Barr is at least as evil as Sessions in different, and things like the, you know, I mean, I'm sure Sessions would have also ordered the tear gassing of the protesters at Lafayette Square too. But, you know, I think that's really just Trump's cabinet just presents this problem. Like, you know, there's so many, like the guy who basically let Jeffrey Epstein walk is one of the three or four best people serving Trump. You know, like, it's just, you know, I mean, it's ridiculous. Like, you know, like they have, like, Betsy DeVos, you know, Pruitt, you know, Mark Meadows is awful, you know, like, just, I mean, just like some of the worst human beings, like, you know, Ryan Zinke. I mean, it's just like, you know, like Steve Mnuchin, for Christ's sakes, is like arguably like the least odious Trump, you know, and he's handicapping the Fed right now to, like, you know, deepen a recession. I mean, it's just unbelievable how bad, like, this, you know, this how many bad people there are. So it's almost like when you emphasize one, you're almost always, like, you know, almost diminishing how bad the other ones are.
Well, when he left office, I mean, I think I made the argument that Rex Tillerson is probably the worst Secretary of State in history because he went to war with his own agency, you know, basically trying to almost dismantle the American foreign policy apparatus from within. And yet we've almost forgotten about Tillerson because that's so many horrible cabinet officials ago. I don't know if Rob would agree with about my Tillerson discussion, but I mean, you know, he's pretty awful.
So, I mean, I've had some conversations with some State Department people, and I am curious sort of in the end how it's going to come out, right? So however disgraceful and sort of really repugnant Pompeo is, my understanding is that the sort of core people within the State Department actually like him a little bit better than they liked Tillerson, because he is more of a sort of Washington bureaucrat, right, where I stand is where I sit sort of person. And he did look out for the State Department, right? You know, that he tried to sort of maintain its position, whereas Tillerson was this outside person brought in to basically gut it. And so that even though, you know, Tillerson's above board policy positions were better than Pompeo's, that Pompeo has been a better steward of the agency is sort of the what I've largely been hearing from that. And I think where you weigh that depends a lot on, you know, how much of a connection you have with these people. And of course, I know people there. And so I'm a little bit sensitive to sort of how they think about the difference between Pompeo. I mean, I can say I consider Pompeo to be an utter disgrace. I'll go even farther. Most of the military personnel I know, and Pompeo, of course, was a West Point graduate. Most of the military personnel I know consider Pompeo to be a complete disgrace. And so, you know, Pompeo's sort of above board political positions are repugnant and awful, even if he has managed to protect the State Department from the worst depredations of the rest of the administration.
Yeah, Pompeo also in American Carnage, he's also, like, you know, seen as a buffoon even by many Republicans, sort of up there like Kevin McCarthy. You know, he comes off really badly, you know, you know, he's, you know, even in the context of the contemporary Republican Party. But again, that doesn't, you know, like there's so many, you know, candidates and again, really just different types of, you know, and I think same thing with Sessions and Barr, there's like different types of evil. And it is sort of almost very difficult to parse out what's the very worst. And you see like Betsy DeVos telling people to resist in the, by the way, has Biden picked an education secretary yet?
No, there's been some. There are some promising candidates, but that there was a couple of names dropped yesterday that look pretty promising, including one who's pretty overtly anti-charter, which of course would be a rejection not only in many ways of course the Trump education part of it, but also Obama. As I've stated before, you know, this was Obama's probably his worst policy position, and in my position certainly less, especially given the context. As much as people on the left focus on the drones, you know, in the larger scheme of American military action, you know, it's probably less, you know, that's a different moral debate. But in any case, the education policy was truly abysmal. And Biden seems to be moving away from that. And I think, again, because Biden is a kind of centrist in the party and the party has moved significantly left on this. So, you know, Michelle Rhee is no longer particularly welcome in, you know, I mean, maybe in private meetings, but not in the kind of public Democratic Party. So.
And I think it's also where like, there are certain advantages to a transactional politician like Biden. And I think one of them is that he'll actually have, you know, labor will have more of a voice at the table in a Biden administration than the Obama administration. So I think that like it's a combination of the party moving away from education reform. And I think Biden cares a lot more about what teachers unions think than Obama does. And I think that his, Dr. Jill helps there as well. Although, you know, as appalled as I am to see a fourth, tier film critic critique her dissertation. I do think that that's, I'm actually interested to see that because I think that's one where I think that you could see a real improvement from Obama. And that seems to be the signal so far. So there's some cautious optimism there anyway.
Yeah, and I think the environmental appointees as well. I mean, Deb Haaland was just named Secretary of the Interior. That does briefly limit the House majority, which is of course pretty shaky anyway, but you know, she certainly, not only is the first Native woman to lead this agency that of course includes the BIA, but also, the public lands. I think that that's a sure sign that Biden is going to reestablish Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments in their full original impact, because you know the tribes in Utah have been very much behind those larger national monuments. That's certainly a good sign. The climate team is a pretty good sign, including same as well about John Kerry and whatever is an old elite, but certainly that is somebody who gets international attention just because of his status over his very very long career. So. You know, the appointees are a mixed bag, I think, right now. But I think that on those certain kinds of domestic policy issues anyway, so there's some promising things. The Labor Department, on the other hand, basically you have the various unions fighting, infighting over which white guy they want, which is very, very, very AFL-CIO. So that still remains to be seen. Rob, I do have a question, though, on the defense side of this. The appointment of Lloyd Austin is an interesting one, not so much because he's the first Black defense secretary, although I mean I guess that's a milestone, but because he's a recently retired general, and that it seems like we know that Trump blew up that norm. I'm a little surprised to see Biden go down that road, and I'm wondering what you think of it and what the people that you talk to think about this.
You know, it's a really great question. So, the problem for Democrats in the wake of turn back time here, the problem for the Democrats in say 92 was that there simply was no foreign policy bench, right? That they had been 12 years out of power. The Carter administration was fairly disastrous on foreign policy. And there were really no veterans coming out of that who were useful. So the bench was fairly open. And then, you had to cycle through sort of a number of sort of interesting different people. Les Aspin died, right? By the Obama administration, right, Obama steps up and includes Gates, which at the time was widely lauded sort of on both sides, but people have sort of reconsidered the wisdom of that. The basic problem being that there simply aren't enough Democrats of sufficient stature to be Secretary of Defense, right? Who have, you know, a degree of technocratic expertise, but also a degree of heft among the major constituencies on the center left and the left to be able to fill this role, right? And so, you know, the answer to this seemed fairly straightforward with the Biden administration, where it was simply going to be Michelle Flournoy, right? It was that was the anticipated person. She was widely liked on the center left. She was popular in the think tank community. She is widely considered to be intellectually gifted. There was some pushback from the left side because she was perceived as being too interventionist. And, I don't know. And that perhaps that was the I doubt that in Secretary of Defense, of all things, Biden would allow his left wing to have a veto over the Secretary of Defense position. But, you know, the choice of Austin is very curious. And most of it seems to come down to the suggestion that Biden had a personal relationship with Austin, that Beau knew Austin and spoke well of him, that Biden and Austin had similar views on both Iraq and Afghanistan during the Obama administration. And so, he was chosen because he's basically in simpatico with Biden's views on defense. Now, the problem with that is that, you know, it sort of reinforces this idea that Democratic civilians just aren't able to do security policy, right? And it's especially galling when there are, you know, there's at least one and probably more than one, like literal Democratic civilians sitting there who are experts in defense policy. You know, with respect to the civil-military relations norms, I acknowledge the concerns. I don't take them, they don't tend for me to be as much of a game stopper as they are for some people, that Austin, is a retired military. You know, retired military can do the job, right? The only question is, are we establishing a norm where retired military are always going to get this job, which does then have, you know, significant implications because, significant implications for civil military relations. I doubt. Well, okay, let me push back one more time here, right? And this is getting a little bit more into the weeds, right? It is also a little bit fascinating to me that sort of all of the people who are taken seriously for the Secretary of Defense position are people who are Army or Marine Corps. And they're not Air Force or Navy. And this is also kind of interesting to me because one of the people I saw floated for Secretary of Defense in a potential Bernie administration was Mike Mullen, who of course was the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs and who was Navy. And so, you know, the concern with somebody like Austin following on somebody like Mattis is that you have this sort of permanent ground forces military person in the cabinet that sort of distorts civil military relations. I think those concerns are a little bit overblown. But I don't know. I mean, it's a really interesting development. I'm not even. I mean, I guess he seems extremely likely to be confirmed unless the Democrats defect on the waiver issue, because he needs a waiver to become Secretary of Defense. But I still kind of wish it was Michelle Flournoy.
Yeah, yeah. It's very interesting. I think I want to switch now to talk about sort of, I guess, the American South a bit, but. You know, there's kind of two related things I want to talk about. One is perhaps more obvious, and that's where the Georgia election stands. We talked about the stimulus bill a little bit earlier, and it seems very clear that the only reason McConnell caved on this is because he's worried about the two Georgia senators losing that race. And Scott, I know you had a post today about this is how pressure works, and this is the positive thing. I mean, where do you think, you know, a few weeks out now, that we stand on the Georgia issue, and is there any immediate lessons that we need to understand about about this election that or actions to take or anything else? Like, what should we be knowing about this Georgia election right now?
Well, you know, I think that Warnock and Ossoff have run impressive campaigns and just, you know, really focusing hard on this. They don't want to do anything for you. And I still think that leaves room to pivot, you know, that you can point out that, you know, if you want the $1,200 you got last time, you're going to need to get them out of office. You know, you can still point out the extent to which they held this up. You know, you could you know, hopefully tie it to the amount of money they're spending on their insider trading portfolios. You know, and I think that, you know, there is, you know, certainly, you know, passing this, you know, probably gives some help, you know, but I think if that's something you have to accept, I mean, I think it would be really dumb to turn this down, you know, because, you know, on the one hand, they can certainly win anyway. On the one hand, they might have lost anyway. You know, I don't think we can really judge that, you know, and honestly, I just, you know, I've had a certain amount of optimism. I mean, I did push back early, and I seem to have convinced Iglesias at least that, you know, that all these people were saying, well, you know, Democrats never win these runoffs. It's like, I mean, it's like most of these are like in fucking Louisiana or whatever, like who cares? You know, there's also, you know, when was the last runoff in which the, you know, Democratic presidential candidate carried the state? And the thing is, it's just, it's so, you know, everything about the 2020 presidential election is so weird and unusual that I just don't know how you bring in, you know, because yes, you know, there was, you know, won't be able to replicate that turnout. But the thing is, this time the turnout was really high on both sides. And, you know, so Trump also had a very strong motivating factor on the Republican Party. And whereas he's basically been spending the last 2 weeks calling all Georgia Republican quislings and claiming that the elections are rigged. So, you know, I just don't see any way of knowing how to evaluate this. And obviously, you're not going to pay any attention to polls at this point, because, they're almost certainly going to be within a margin of error that is, that is not going to be trustworthy. So to me, I just think it's, you know, I have a certain, you know, they'll have enough money to work with. You know, and I think Abrams, is genuinely impressive. And I hopefully that she'll be able to keep turnout up a bit, but I don't know. I mean, it's difficult because the stakes of this are so high. And I just don't, it's very hard to convey that to the public, but, and again, it's not as if, you know, a 50-person Democratic Senate is going to, you know, pass the next great society. But still being able to get, you know, cabinet officials and federal judges confirmed is something. And I think in particular, there's sort of a tendency to think of ending the filibuster as a dichotomy. And like a Joe Manchin median vote Senate is not completely ending the legislative filibuster, but there's a lot of, you know, you could also, like, I think Manchin will be much more amenable to, you know, not strictly enforcing the Byrd rule, for example, you know, that there are sort of ways, you know, that, you know, yeah, and really that's what Republicans are trying to do with the, you know, the Affordable Care Act repeal was to basically call a reconciliation bill, you know, stretching the boundaries of that. So, you know, I mean, there's certain things that can be done with the 50 seat, you know, and even just the one reconciliation bill a year when a relief bill is needed is a big deal. So, you know, hopefully, you know, but so I'm not going to make a firm prediction, but all I can say is I think that there's a real chance Democrats can win that. And I think that they're certainly, I won't blame Warnock or Ossoff, but, you know, as far as I can tell, they seem to be running good campaigns. And the fact that McConnell is willing to cave on the stimulus suggests to me that the internal public polling Republicans are running are suggesting that their attacks are effective. So, you know, if Republicans internals had Loeffler and Perdue winning, I don't think we'd be seeing this. So, I think there's a certain reason for optimism, but I don't know how you two see it.
I mean, I am looking forward to the Cletus Safari to somewhere in Georgia to try to figure out, because there are going to be voters out there who vote for Ossoff but not Warnock, and there are going to be other voters who vote for Warnock but not Ossoff, and I just want to know why, right? I mean, in the end, I think that's just a fascinating interview to like try to figure out what's in the heads of these people who would vote for, you know, what reasons did they have to vote for one and not the other, right? Because there are going to be these humans out there who do this. And I'm just fascinated to hear about that. So,
yeah, that would be really something if one did. I mean, it actually seems like Warnock is if anything, polling better. Although that's also, there's the, our old friend, the racism versus misogyny questions. Like Hillary Clinton would have an explanation for why Warnock is outrunning all. I mean, you know, I think that, it's probably, I think Warnock is a more talented politician, although, you know, Ossoff has certainly been, you know, compared, you know, he's certainly run a better campaign than his House, you know, and even that House campaign wasn't that bad. I think that that's it. But I mean, it does seem like, you know, the corruption sticks to Loeffler more than Perdue, for reasons that I think are pretty obvious at this stage of history. And again, Hillary Clinton must love seeing all this information about how, you know, basically our entire federal apparatus was breached by, you know, it's like, have you ever seen a single elite political editor try to make a defense on the merits for the fucking emails coverage in 2016? Like, it's just, you know, like, I still see how, like, you know, I mean, there are choices that editors make, like, you know, and there are decisions they make, which I can at least understand. Like, I personally don't give a fuck if Cal Cunningham has an affair, but that's the rules of the game. And you have to know that's going to get you negative publicity. Like, I'm fine with that. But the emails thing was just like, it was of no substantive interest. It was of no prurient interest. Like, it was just pure, like, we need something to pretend that Clinton and Trump are equivalent, and this is something. And the fact that we ended up with somebody who's, like, vastly worse on information security issues is really just, like, the chef's kiss of all this. Well,
I was going to go in one direction, but since you brought it up, let's go at another, which is this, and I've only started really paying attention to this, but this hacking issue. And the unbelievable, evidently, breach of security that has been taking place. And I don't know, you know, I don't have a formed opinion on this yet, except to say that it sounds pretty messed up and pretty, not another example of the gross incompetence of this administration. But I don't know if Rob or if you have any thoughts about this, and so much of it is kind of defense related.
Well, I mean, so the first thing is we don't have a clear sense of the extent of the damage, and we're never really going to have a clear sense of the extent of the damage, right? I mean, just because Russia and the prime suspect on this is at the moment Russia, but you know, there are always questions about attribution, right? Now to some extent, these questions are designed to create what somebody coined as implausible deniability, right? So that you know, where all signs point to Russia, but, you know, there's enough doubt and there's no, you know, you can't in the end, you know, sort of put person A doing thing B at place C at a time, so that, you know, sort of Russia, pro-Russian trolls will always have the opportunity to say, well, they haven't proved that it was Russia, right? And still, people are still making this claim about, you know, what happened in 2016. And I think, you know, noted friend of the blog, GG, is very vocal in that there's no definitive evidence that Russia is doing this. But all the cybersecurity professionals that I'm familiar with are pretty solidly that this is Russia. And to be clear, right, I mean, you know, this is the game, right? I mean, it's not Russia's fault that Russia is trying to steal a ton of stuff from the United States national security apparatus, right? That this is how the game is played. And so I don't actually blame Russia for doing any of this, right? It's stealing stuff from the United States national security bureaucracy is fully within, you know, your standard spycraft stuff. It's certainly much better than trying to steal the election. But yeah, I mean, it seems to be a very significant breach. The extent to which this can be laid at the feet, we don't know yet, right? Ways we'll never really know. In the same sense that we still don't really know, for example, the extent to which the Bush administration was responsible, or the Bush administration allowed 9/11 to happen, right, in terms of incompetence, right? Because, you know, something, it's just very hard to draw lines of causation on these issues. But the hack does seem to have been very significant. It did have affect numerous agencies. It is a clear indication that whatever else was going on, the Trump administration was not doing a bang-up job on cybersecurity. It's not a good thing from a national security point of view.
Yeah, and I have to say, as a single-issue Trump information security voter, I'm pretty appalled by what's gone down, frankly. I'm going to have to ask Dean Backett for my subscription.
Yeah, the other question I was going to ask, you know, I had a post yesterday. We're recording this here on Thursday night, and I had a post yesterday about a New York Times interview with John Tester about rural voters. And you know, Tester, who I respect a lot, you know, I mean, he's basically as good of a senator as Dianne Feinstein, and he's from Montana, right? I mean, you know, I like John Tester, and he's won three tough Senate elections. I have a lot of respect for that. But you know, I'm reading this article about Democrats' struggle with rural voters, and you know, it's possible that some of the issues this time around that we were Democrats really didn't do as well, especially down ballot as expected, was because Republicans don't take public safety seriously, and so therefore we're doing door knocking, and Democrats weren't. And oh, maybe this is a piece of it, but you know, I listened to somebody who should know and probably does know more about rural politics than almost anybody around. And all I'm seeing is sort of platitudes about, well, you know, Democrats just don't know how to talk to us. And Chuck Schumer shouldn't come here because, you know, subtext, he's a Jewish guy from New York. And at the end, Tester sort of kind of, you know, starts talking about Facebook. And to me, it was like, that's the actual issue here, right? Is you have rural voters who already maybe had some problems with the kind of diversity, particularly of the contemporary United States, being radicalized by what is effectively a, you know, bad stories on the internet. And, you know, I guess this really made me think, like, you know, what is the answer? What is a step forward in terms of talking to rural voters? Because I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, you Farley, like I'm doubting that your decade plus in Kentucky is making you feel good about Democrats going into Harlan County and, you know, retaking like 1950s level of vote share. And so, you know, is the rural question kind of a lost cause at this point?
Right. So, I mean, this is interesting because I actually had lunch with Amy McGrath after her 2018 defeat in the KY6 race, which was the House race. And what she told me was very interesting, right? She said that, you know, during the election, she had spent her entire time in the counties that surrounded Fayette County. So Fayette County and Lexington are identical, right? The city limits and the county limits are identical. So Fayette is Lexington, but KY6 also has a number of sort of other largely rural areas. And she said, like, look, I only came into Lexington ever to do fundraising, right? I would come in and I would do fundraising, and then I would spend all of the rest of my time out in the surrounding rural communities. And I would talk to them about everything, right? I would talk to them about healthcare, about employment policy, about addiction, like everything. And then she said, you know, and that's what killed us, because they still didn't vote for us, right? They came to our meetings and they listened to our media, and then they voted for the other guy, right? In exactly the same proportions that they had voted the last time. And because I didn't spend enough time in Lexington, like my Lexington margins weren't as high as they needed to be in order to make up the difference, right? And, you know, that's a, you know, framed that way, it's a really depressing reality, right? That you can present solutions for rural people that are good, like strong public policy, rural, you know, solutions, right, on healthcare, on every other damn thing, and they're just not gonna vote for you, right? And there really is an imbalance on this, right? Because, you know, urban Democrats just don't spend that much time thinking about what happens in the hinterland, right? But people in the hinterland spend a lot of time thinking about and hating on what happens in cities, right? And there, I mean, all you have to do is like sit around and listen to, you know, contemporary country music radio versus like any kind of other music, right? That there's so much of contemporary country music which is about hating cities, right? And you know, there it's an asymmetric situation, and I don't know what's to be done about that.
Yeah, and Eric, you wrote about the, you know, the same piece by this sort of local Democratic official in rural Wisconsin. And, you know, the easy answer, the sort of Jackman answer, is that, you know, Democrats just need better public policy towards rural areas. And to be clear, like you, I'm not saying that that hasn't been a failure, because, you know, it certainly has, that, you know, Democrats have generally also supported, you know, trade policies that have, you know, hollowed out manufacturing, you know, and without really a solution. Now, again, it's sort of easier, you know, part of this is trade policy, part of this is just sort of capital, you know, You know, that it's sort of easier said than done, you know, what you do about the Rust Belt. But certainly, I'm not saying that there can't be better policy options. But having said that, you know, the most important progressive policy of the Obama administration, the Medicaid expansion, was something that disproportionately helps white rural areas, you know, saved a lot of hospitals in states like Kentucky, and, you know, didn't help. And on the other hand, the really key thing is that Trump has done absolutely jack shit for, like, any rural area. Like, not, you know, like, basically just, you know.
Negative jack shit.
Right.
Negative jack shit. No, yeah. It's not that. Yeah. He has been a plague upon rural America, and that fucker still voted for
him. Yeah, like, it's just basically just, like, destroyed farming communities and gave them some of that money back. Like, that's basically it. You know, it's not like, you know, small town America has gotten prosperous. You know, so this idea that if you just give the material things they'll vote. And, you know, this really goes back to American history. Like, you know, did, you know, the Great Society was great policy-wise. Did it, you know, make great a permanent Democratic majority? Like, fuck no, precisely the opposite. You know, same thing, you know, and in the New Deal, that was just disguised by the fact that the Democratic coalition was so huge that they remained largely in power in Congress. But as we all know, between 1938 and 1963, Congress is effectively controlled by Southern Democrats and Republicans. You know, so it's not like the New Deal led to this, you know, viable progressive coalition. Reconstruction, you know, I don't think we have to say, you know, talk more about that. So, you know, it's sort of, you know, the easy way of squaring this is to say that, you know, good policy is just good politics. But, you know, there's very little evidence for that in American history, which isn't. And again, let me be clear. That's not a reason not to do the good policy, you know, but I just don't know, you know. And again, the fact that, you know, Trump was able to, if anything, expand his margins in some of these areas without, you know, doing, as you say, doing literally less than nothing. It's pretty clear that something else is going on there. And it's, but I just, you know, it sort of defies easy solutions just by its nature. And we just have the fact that our institutions overrepresent these areas so much that Republicans just don't have to change. I mean, that's the other thing, you know, that's what allows them to be completely non-responsive on things like COVID, and that they, you know, they effectively don't face Democratic elections. So, you know, there's so it's a really difficult problem. So I don't know if you've thought any more about this, Eric. Have you?
I think you guys, you know, I mean, again, like, you know, I have a lot of respect for John Tester, but I mean, what is the answer, and where we move past just sort of cliches about needing to talk to people or whatever? And like, I don't think that there is one. I mean, did Steve Bullock not, you know, who had been, you know, an effective and pretty popular governor of Montana, and, you know, he doesn't do particularly well against, you know, a guy who's from New Jersey, right? Like, Gianforte is a New Jersey East Coast thug, he's the kind of guy that rural people claim to hate, right? Loud. You know, this loud Italian guy from the East Coast, and he's, you know, he's a big jerk and all of this. And he, you know, beats up that reporter, Ben Smith, and it helps him, you know? And so despite this kind of, you know, I believe, you know, I absolutely believe Rob when he says that, you know, these rural people are thinking about how bad the cities are. And yet when one of these really bad people come from the cities and decide to move there because they're rich, they're all about him because he's able to channel their resentments. And the same with Donald Trump, right? I mean, who is more urban than Donald J. Trump? Nobody, right? He's literally the worst of your kind of urban elite. And yet, you know, he's able to channel their resentments. And I think that, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, who's another labor guy, and, you know, writes a lot about labor. He's worked in the union movement for a long, long time. And, you know, and you know, he was talking about being part of a group that of other labor people who are trying to figure out what the heck to make out of this election. And I think I think that's kind of where everybody is right now, right? Because, you know, there are a lot of questions that we need to be answering that we don't really have the vocabulary for, right? After 2016, you know, there's these debates, like, is it about economics? Is it about racism? Is it about misogyny? Maybe it's all these things to a certain extent. But the point is, there was a conversation to be had because people felt like they had the answer. And I don't think anybody feels like they exactly have the answer anymore, because all of the kind of, you know, all of the answers that everybody sort of just went knee-jerk to, which was, of course, their own pre-existing position on the Democratic Party, were all kind of proven to not really be true, right? It's not like, you know, it's not like there was a big, you know, a wave in 2020 after all of this. I mean, very little change in 2016, et cetera, et cetera. And so I don't know. I mean, but I think it's John Tester doesn't know either. And he's from Montana and he's the senator. And this is the real problem. So no, I don't know. But I think that I'm not saying we need to figure it out, but we need to have answers as to what's going on and at least strategize about that, whatever that may be.
And so one of the things about the campaign that needed to get more attention is that on that last speaking tour, every time Trump would go to like one of the kind of the smaller rural cities, he would immediately start saying like, I would never come back to a shithole like Erie, Pennsylvania. If I wasn't like, he'd like, look, just completely explicitly like, good Christ. And I hope never to set foot in this like godforsaken shithole again. But you know, I guess I need your vote. So what the, you know, and it didn't matter. Like, and can you imagine like if John Kerry came in and said, you know, there's no place I would less rather be than Schenectady fucking New York, but you know, I guess I have, you know, like it's just astounding, you know, just literally like the, you know, the rich, you know, Manhattan real estate heir with like gold toilets, you know, come to all these Rust Belt cities and talk about what like unlivable shitholes they are, to enthusiastic crowds and enthusiastic support. And that just, you know, like there clearly are complicated things going on here. You know, and you know, not only you know, like, and yeah, and I made a little fun of Jackman, but the Democratic centrist approach, which is pretty much, you know, have a guy from, you know, a moderate from Scranton run, didn't help either. So it's not like there's no wing of the party that has a good answer to this. You know, it's not, you know, that sort of one solution hasn't failed. There's just no, you know, so I don't have the answer to that. But it really is remarkable the extent to which, you know, Trump makes no effort whatsoever to hide his utter contempt for like the rural people that like are critical to his base. And it just doesn't make any difference. And that's what makes the you just have to learn how to talk to people thing. It sounds great, but you know, I don't, you know, it's clear something more going on there.
The only thing Republicans failed on and probably would have helped them is just pass out some, you know, Trump branded fentanyl at every rally. You know? I mean, you have a drug problem. Let me help you out with that. Here's some drugs. I mean, I do think that is actually the critical point is like, we might say, you know, some of the Jackman political analysis sometimes is hooey, and you know, sometimes it is. But so is the left liberal analysis of these things. So is the centrist analysis of these things, right? Everyone has had their talking points for 15 or 20 years, and like none of them are actually true. No matter where you are on that political spectrum, like none of them have actually turned out to be particularly true. Unless you're a conservative and realize that race baiting is the way to power. And that has been proven true in many cases. So I don't know.
Oh, but Rob, you wanted to make a point about Tom Vilsack.
Well, so this was brought up by and this touches, I think, on a lot of the themes that we've talked about today, which is the Biden appointees and sort of the relationship with rural America. There was a pretty interesting, and I don't know enough to say whether it was good, but there's a pretty interesting American Prospect article about the transition, which talked about sort of how loath Tom Vilsack is in rural America. And I was just completely incapable of evaluating the set of truth claims on this, right? It certainly seems plausible to me that Tom Vilsack is widely loathed in rural America and has permanently ruined Biden's outreach to rural Americans. And B, that nobody knows who Tom Vilsack is, and nobody cares. Evaluate between these two reasons. And maybe that's because there's just not a lot of sort of extensive coverage of these areas beyond sort of the Cletus Safari. You know, he presided over a series of policy disasters in the Obama administration, and now he's completely loathed in all rural constituencies and being viewed as this catastrophe of a pick. And I'm curious whether
You know, I don't know. I don't know whether Vilsack, I mean, I didn't read that article. I mean, I think that the Vilsack pick was certainly as uninspired as it could possibly be. You know, I mean, I mean, Vilsack was in there for the entire 8 years under Obama. And so he didn't screw anything up too so badly as to get canned. You know, and I don't, you know, I think that this was an opportunity to switch the focus of the Ag Department away from supporting big, you know, big ag and toward hunger issues. And that's why there were a lot of people that were hoping that Marsha Fudge would get that position instead of Vilsack. And I think that would have been very useful as well. I have a lot of trouble believing that having the right ag secretary is what's going to bring rural America back to the Democratic Party. You know, it may be, you know, again, you know, there are, you know, when you think about rural America, or a place like, you know, the Corn Belt, I mean, there are, you know, there's big agribusiness, and then there's, you know, smaller kind of enterprises that are losing power. And I suspect if it was a prospect article focusing on those smaller enterprises, and certainly Vilsack is a man of big ag, and, you know, has been a lobbyist for them, et cetera. So I don't know, but I do, if Democrats are going to take back rural America, probably the core constituency that is in the end going to be people of color. I mean, I think that's just kind of how it's going to be, including Native Americans, which is part of the reason why. I mean, everybody focuses on Maricopa County in Arizona and for reason, but without that overwhelming Navajo vote, Donald Trump wins Arizona. You know, that New Mexico has been critical for, you know, that both the Native and Hispano rural vote has been critical for the Democrats becoming dominant in New Mexico. And that, you know, in the South, particularly the rural side, you know, places like Mississippi and Alabama and South Carolina, these are not heavily rural urban states. South Carolina changing in this, but certainly Mississippi and Alabama. And, you know, it is in these rural Black Belt counties that Democrats have their strongest advantage. And so, you know, from a purely political perspective, I'm not really sure what Vilsack adds other than good relations with agribusiness and an easy confirmation.
Yeah. And somebody who has, you know, and Biden is a relate. And again, we talked about some of the positive aspects of the transactional politician. Some of the negative aspects are basically if Joe Biden doesn't know you, it's very difficult to sort of get a job in his administration. So it's sort of that's the Vilsack is the downside of the Biden approach. And, you know, the balance of that is obviously none of us would have, you know, ranked him in the top 10 of our, you know, ranked choice ballots, which, again, one can argue that that's why it's good we're not unilaterally picking the Democratic nominee, depending on how you think the other ones would have fared. But, you know, I think this was, you know, that the Vils, you know, and again, it's not the end of the world or anything, but it's the, you know, exactly the kind of, you know, spinning in wheels that one had to be concerned about if Biden was the nominee and became president.
So I know it's probably about time to get going, but before we leave, are there, you know, we're kind of at the one thing we have, one person that we've mercifully not had to talk about a whole lot in this podcast is Donald Trump. Except sort of in this past disasters. Any sort of predictions over the next couple of weeks of Trump and the dead enders and, you know, what sort of happens here before we meet again?
I mean, the word is now that he may go through and fire everybody else in foreign policy and everybody else in the Defense Department. And it's really hard at this point to be able to understand whether this is an effort to sort of clear out the bureaucracy and install loyalists before Biden, which would be something that is wholly intelligible from a bureaucratic point of view, or whether it is just his sort of mindless rage against anyone who does or knows anything, which is also purely intelligent, completely intelligible from any sort of understanding of Donald Trump. So that's kind of the stuff that's going on now. But yeah, other than that, I just want this all to be over.
I mean, wouldn't Biden just fire all those people and rehire all the people that got fired? Or is that harder to do than sound?
Well, but no, that's probably what would happen, but it would simply complicate. It would simply add a sort of layer of things that Biden needs to do to move forward. Right. So it would be a fuck you to the Biden team in a way to just sort of make everything to gum up the gears a little bit as in the first 100 days.
Yeah, and it's pretty clear that that's a lot of what he's going to do. And it'll almost be interesting to see like how crazy the pardons get. The Assange one is actually genuinely fascinating. You know, I wrote about that last week, but there's so many like, you know, it on the one hand would be an absolutely like great owning the libs. But on the other hand, it's, you know, there's nothing Trump likes more than to like tell the people who are like his biggest sycophants to eat shit. So it's a very, you know, and he's of no use to him anymore. So it's actually like, you know, there's going to be lots of cases like that where it's actually going to be interesting to see like who gets the Trump's reward and who doesn't. But I can tell you who's not going to be pardoned is reality winner.
Yeah, well, I was going to say nobody would, you know, in case Glenn wasn't on the pro-Trump left, in quotation marks, strongly enough, you know, pardoning Assange would pretty much guarantee that Glenn spends the next 4 years demanding that Trump return to office in 2024. And of course, we're probably going to see that anyway. So it'll be joyful.
No. It'll never be. Glenn never endorses political candidates, right? It's simply that he will not speak an ill word of the Trump administration in the next 4 years, and he will focus all of his ire on Hunter Biden, who is clearly the most evil human being who has ever emerged from a woman's womb, right? And I think we do have to shift fairly conclusively from anti-Trump to just simply the pro-Trump left to describe this group of humans.
Although don't forget, he will also spend the next 4 years talking about the great, the truly greatest progressive heart of the Senate, Josh Hawley.
Yes, of course. Yes. The populist of the Republican Party. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Well, there is a football game on in 5 minutes. And so that sounds like a good time to leave. So gentlemen, thank you all very much. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you. Good luck to Justin Herbert, and you're welcome for our sloppy COVID protocols getting you a spot in the Pac-12 championship. So do work with it effectively.
Yes.
you're welcome.
Yes, I know. You can't leadership like you see at the Pac-12 is really only replicable with the party. So
yeah, and the thing is that what's interesting is that UW has actually like handled this extremely well. Like they're just, you know, the president more or less laughed at the idea of going back to class before like next fall. So it's for whatever reason, but the football team is always its own island. So
Oregon has had, I mean, of a major program, Oregon's had the most success in keeping it away of anybody, right? Which allowed our shitty football team this year to win several football games that they should have lost, right? Because these other crappy Pac-12 programs were coming in without their quarterback and their offensive line and so forth.
Let's keep the facts out of this. It was
a championship's a championship. No asterisk.
That's right. I can't wait because USC's not even very good. I mean they've had three less like incredibly lucky wins, including Arizona that lost 70-7. It's Arizona State, for God's sake. And they had a last second comeback to beat them. So I'm waiting for Oregon to beat USC and then get defeated by like 85 points in the Fiesta Bowl. It's gonna be really exciting. So, 2020.
Right.
Anyway. All right, thank you all, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of the Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of the Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,